Hello, hello, welcome to your Extra Morning News Show. My name is Philip DeFranco, and today we're going to be talking about what's keeping the lights on in your home, your office, or factory, and that is magic. It is not magic. When we talk about pollution and global warming, most of us probably think of cars spewing CO2 on the highway, oil spills, toxic chemicals. The greenhouse gas emissions aren't just coming from our cars, they're coming from the way our electricity is produced as well. The electricity that powers your heater during the winter, your computer in your office, or the complex machines in an industrial factory can come from a variety of sources. And that includes harnessing the power of coal, natural gas, oil, nuclear power, the wind, biofuels, the sun, and the Earth's heat. And it's the global emissions that come from producing electricity for our everyday lives that make up about a quarter or more of total emissions. And in fact, in the United States, about 28% of emissions come from electricity production. And so with that said, today we're going to be taking a look at how two countries achieve renewable electricity production and look at one U.S. state as an example of great potential in renewables. And because this situation is more complex than green and not green, I had Dylan Siegel, one of our research writers on the team, just jump into it.
In October 2018, a UN report written and edited by hundreds of top scientists around the world explained that there will be drastic consequences for the world if we don't curb our emissions at a very rapid rate. Basically, the Earth has warmed by about 1 degree Celsius since pre-industrial times, and if we reach the 1.5 degree Celsius mark, flood, drought, and extreme heat events will become even more frequent, resulting in poverty for hundreds of millions. At the 2 degree mark, the results will be even more extreme and irreversible. This isn't a tomorrow problem, it's a now problem. The report warned that we must drop carbon pollution by about 45% by 2030 just to slow emissions down enough to reach the 1.5 degree increase and not overshoot. It's safe to say we're at a turning point. And as Phil mentioned, part of curbing our carbon emissions is changing where we get our electricity, which accounts for around a quarter of the world's emissions. The thing is, as consumers, where our electricity is coming from is probably the least visible aspect of global warming. We just flip a switch. It's hardly the same as starting a gas-powered car. So look, I promise it's not all end of the world talk today. We're going to look at two countries that are doing a pretty decent job of reaching 100% renewable electric production, and then talk about one place that has great potential for renewable growth. The fact is that each of these places show that proximity, necessity, and political cohesion seem to be some of the largest driving factors in getting to renewable energy. Let's start on an island. Iceland is a small island nation. It has a population of around 340,000 and is a bit smaller than the size of Pennsylvania, and its electric production is effectively 100% renewable thanks to its unique geography and geology. Some call it the island of fire and ice because of its prolific glaciers and volcanoes. Because the country sits in the North Atlantic Ocean near the Arctic Circle, about 11% is covered by glaciers. And since the island straddles an area where two massive tectonic plates are moving away from each other, it has nearly 200 active volcanoes. Thanks to this unique combination, Iceland sources its electricity for homes and industry using a mixture of hydropower and geothermal energy. With its fire and ice, Iceland uses hydropower to power homes, businesses, and industry across the island, making up 3/4 of total production. Geothermal makes up the remaining quarter, heating homes, swimming pools, and more. But Iceland didn't always have a robust renewable industry. The first hydropower station was reportedly built back in 1904, but the technology didn't really take off until Iceland decided it couldn't rely on oil imports anymore. In the 1970s, international events caused price fluctuations and highlighted Iceland's reliance on imported oil. So they said, "We're in the frickin' Arctic, and we can't rely on other countries." Since then, they've invested heavily in hydro and geothermal power. But it wasn't like flipping a switch, a light switch, if you will. There was a large infrastructural transition that required energy transferring tech to get electricity to consumers and adjusting houses to accept geothermal energy. All that energy was just sitting around waiting to be tapped. Ultimately, a UN report described Iceland's success in renewables not simply due to its proximity to resources, but also because of cohesion between different levels of government in the face of resource scarcity. So, let's talk about a more practical example for some of the world's largest emissions producers. Brazil. It's the largest South American country with more than 200 million people and massive geographic barriers, the deep Amazon rainforest, and hundreds of miles of rivers. In 2016, Brazil was also the 8th largest total energy consumer in the world, and even produced around 3.25 million barrels of oil per day, making it the 9th largest oil producer. But let's take a look at the country's electricity. In 2016, renewables accounted for about 81% of total installed capacity, or how much it could produce. The largest sources of electricity in 2016 were hydro, by a lot. Then fossil fuels like coal, gas, and oil, with biofuels and other renewables and nuclear bringing up the rear.
Hydropower accounts, according to the latest figures of 2017, for 2/3, 65%, 66% of total power generation in Brazil.
That's Professor La Rovere of the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. He's worked for decades on governmental energy planning, the environmental impacts of energy sources, and climate change. Part of the reason Brazil has such massive hydropower is because of Itaipu. Together with Paraguay, Brazil operates the world's second largest hydroelectric plant and dam, Itaipu, situated on the Paraná River. The dam is so massive that it took 18 years, $27 billion, and 40,000 workers to create. Itaipu reportedly produces about 17% of all of Brazil's electricity and around 76% of Paraguay's. An important component of how hydropower has become so important for Brazil is the investment that the government made in hydropower back in the 70s and 80s, and the transmission lines needed to get to population centers. And Brazil had big plans to increase its use of hydropower, but...
You may have a renewable energy source, but to make it sustainable, it's not an easy task.
The first issue is practical. With increasingly volatile weather around the globe, recent drought in Brazil emphasized that even the rivers can stop flowing, and that getting electricity where it's needed is the most important part of energy policy.
As you know, we have seasonal fluctuations of the water availability in hydropower generation, and of course wind and solar are intermittent sources that you can only have power generation when you have wind blowing or during the day. But natural gas allows for meeting this peak demand in those months of the year where you have less water, and in those hours of the day where you don't have wind or solar availability.
Another reason has a lot in common with some Icelanders' own concerns about environmental disruption. Some Brazilians are concerned with how dam construction disrupts native ecosystems in the Amazon, also known as the lungs of the earth, by flooding large areas of land, creating unnatural rivers, and endangering the surrounding communities.
The problem with hydropower development in Brazil in the future is that the most of the potential still untapped is located in the Amazon region. The Amazon region, as you know, is a very fragile ecosystem. So we have to be very careful when planning, designing, and building additional hydropower plants in the Amazon.
The future of hydro in Brazil isn't entirely clear, though. While in 2018, the government announced that it was rethinking some of its plans for hydropower expansion, the new Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, who we've covered before, is reportedly likely to push for more construction of hydropower in the Amazon. Ultimately, while Brazil's strong renewable electricity production is encouraging, there have been environmental costs to achieve this success. There's a lot to learn from Brazil's example, but we're going somewhere else before we tie it all together. Let's talk about Texas. Good old Texas has a wealth of energy resources, booming oil and natural gas, but also vast potential for wind and solar. It contains many energy-intensive industries like oil refining and chemical manufacturing. And yup, Texas is the largest electric consumer in the US. So let's talk about the Lone Star State's electricity makeup. In 2017, usage stats clocked in at 38.8% for natural gas, 32.2% for coal, and 17.4% for wind. And while the top two categories were non-renewables, the Energy Information Administration says that Texas was a huge renewable producer of electricity, has the largest wind power capacity in the states, and is a leader in solar. That's thanks to the strong winds that sweep across the state and the sunshine that bathes Texas. And wind is coming up. According to the EIA, there are another 5,000 megawatts of wind capacity under construction, or about 25% of Texas' 2016 installed capacity. Some have credited Texas' swift rise in wind power to its independent state electric grid, ERCOT, that doesn't interface with the federal permitting processes. The other component of its success seems to be a $7 billion project to build power lines to transport the wind energy from less populous West Texas to population hubs in East Texas. So, the US leader in wind power is Texas, and wind turbines aren't hurting many people except maybe Don Quixote. But of course, Texas isn't known for wind. It's known for black gold, oil. Texas alone supplies a huge chunk of US oil output, not necessarily for electricity, but there's no doubting that a culture of oil primacy pervades the state that counters a move towards renewables. And that's not stopping anytime soon, maybe not for 49 years, to be precise. In November 2018, the US Geological Survey announced in a report that an area beneath Texas and New Mexico, known as the Permian Basin, contains historic levels of oil and natural gas, 49 years worth of energy at current production rates. The estimate says the basin contains about 46.3 billion barrels of oil, 281 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, and 20 billion barrels of natural gas liquids. Sure, that doesn't mean all of it is entirely reachable, but that's trillions of dollars waiting to be pulled from the ground. Let's put those numbers in perspective for a second. The basin is expected to generate an average of roughly 3.7 million barrels per day, or about a third of total U.S. oil production. In January, companies were pulling so much oil from the ground that there was a bottleneck in shipping. An HSBC report anticipates that barrel per day mark will rise to 5.6 million in 2019, which would make Texas the third largest oil producer in the world without the rest of the U.S. in the equation. And yet, the state has a massive potential for clean wind and solar energy. But many might say that you can't really argue with the trillions of dollars underground and the need for infrastructural overhaul to develop more renewable energy. And kind of like Iceland and Brazil, the biggest factors in deciding energy sources seem to be proximity and necessity. Let's put this all together. Iceland, Brazil, and Texas all required some major infrastructure investments to bring their renewables up to current capacity, whether it was because of oil shocks in the 1970s or the tenacity to cut through the Amazon. And there's a lot that goes into that success that other countries can learn from.
So first of all, human resources, then the appropriate institutional setting, then the political will of a government with a long-term view, because our main problem, our main challenge in building up the capacity of renewable energy is that upfront costs are high, so you need to take into account the long-term benefits. So the government has to come and to have public-private partnerships, have the appropriate institutional setting, and to make it cost-effective to build renewable capacity.
Remember that UN report about Iceland that described cohesion as a huge factor in getting them to such high renewables? That's exactly what Professor La Rovere was talking about. And there's plenty of information to suggest that our renewable resources are simply waiting to be tapped into, the same way Iceland, Brazil, and Texas show. That UN report claims that around 25% of the European population lives in an area suitable for geothermal district heating, or let's compare a map of the US currently installed wind power capacity to its potential. That's less than 1% of our wind potential tapped into. Groups like the Solutions Project even made an infographic map that explores what resources each US state needs to utilize to reach 100% renewable in all energy. Texas should have about 64% coming from wind and another 35-ish% coming from solar. The big question is whether governments around the world will take cohesive action to build new infrastructure, like we've seen in Iceland, Brazil, and Texas. Unfortunately, this is something that we'd rather not wait and see about.
So with all of that said, it definitely looks like an uphill battle. And when we look to the news, it seems like there's something terrible every single week about the climate. I mean, we've got reports about the oceans warming from the fall and early January. We have the California wildfires we talked about, the heat waves in Japan and Australia. But with all of that said, I did want to pass the question off to you regarding your thoughts on this topic. And also, I mean, some specific questions. Do you see governments actually getting it together to change things, whether it be now or in the near future if certain things change? Also, are you optimistic given the innovations we've seen in places like Iceland, Brazil, and Texas? But of course, as always, any and all thoughts, I'd love to hear from you in the comments down below. Also, while you're at it, if you want more of these extra deep dives, the Philip DeFranco Show, be sure to hit that subscribe button, click that bell to turn on notifications. But with that said, I love you faces, I hope you have a fantastic day, and I'll see you again later on this channel with the brand new Philip DeFranco Show.